7. Oh dear. Virgil would like you to know that Aeneas had a nurse called Caeta, who was very important to him, even though she's never been mentioned before and never will be again. Also, she's dead. But at least Aeneas remembered to bury her. It wasn't too long before Aeneas and his men saw land. Neptune, who, by the way, was on their side now, in case you hadn't noticed, made sure they skirted around Circe and avoided being turned into pigs or imitating the Odyssey too closely. They had their first glimpse of the River Tiber. Not that, you know, that would mean anything to them at this point. Erato, one of the muses of poetry, Virgil and I will give you a little backstory now on Latium, which will basically become Rome, in case you've missed that. King Latinus, original name, was super old, as befits a very good, respectable king in this story, and probably descended from Saturn, because we have to make sure the Romans had divine relations coming from all angles. King Latinus had a son who died very young, and now he only had a daughter left. Naturally, Lavinia, as that was her name, was probably a teenager and therefore a suitable age to be rid of. I mean, married respectably off. All the men of the world begged for her hand, but of course Turnus, the most handsome and cliched Prince Charming of them all, was the one who wanted it the most, and no one was more in favour of this match than Queen Amata, Latinus's husband, Lavinia's mother. She probably fancied Turnus a little bit herself. However, there were a few little issues with this marriage. For example, there was one day a swarm of bees around the sacred laurel tree in the palace courtyard. It was dedicated to Apollo, by the way. The bees made themselves quite cosy on the top of this tree. Conveniently, a prophet interpreted this as a stranger coming with an army and taking over the kingdom, whereas I would have just interpreted it as a nuisance. Maybe that's why I'm not a prophet. Another day, I think it was, you know, probably a Thursday, Lavinia's hair basically caught on fire, which must have been quite a nasty shock. Once again, it was prophesied that her fame would be long and great, but that a war would come, whereas I would have just suggested there might have been a heatwave coming. Understandably, Latinus was finding this all a little bit unnerving, so he went to visit the oracle of Faunus, his apparently prophetic father. That's useful and convenient for the story, isn't it? Where all the Italian tribes would go if they wanted to kill a bull in exchange for a few lines of confusion. Here you came, and after sacrificing some sheep, you'd stay the night and the god would visit you in bed. Interpret that as you will. Latinus had just got cosy on a bed of fleece when a great voice called out.
We told you enough times, Latinus. How more obvious does it get? Your daughter will marry a stranger who will mess up your city, but together they'll build a fab new empire that you'll never get to see, but it'll do pretty well, all things considered. Thanks for the sheep.
It didn't take long for rumour to spread this around, and as she did, the Trojans were just pulling up ashore. They all sat down beneath some shade and ate some fruit on top of flatbreads, which doesn't really seem that big a deal until Iulus bit into his flatbread and made the fairly poor joke.
Hey, dad, look, we're eating our tables.
Isn't it hilarious? This didn't quite get the reaction Iulus was hoping for. Aeneas, thinking back to book 5, leapt to his feet.
Bloody hell! We've made it! This is it! Italy!
This is it. Iulus looked around with a sour, sulky expression. Typical teenager.
When you're so hungry on a foreign shore, you're forced to eat your tables. This is what my dad meant. Quick, everyone, pour a libation to Jupiter before we jinx it.
Quite beside himself, Aeneas shoved the nearest foliage on his head, offered prayers to every god and goddess he could think of off the top of his head, think an acceptance speech at the Oscars. And when Jupiter responded with 3 peals of thunder, Everyone quickly followed suit. The next morning, while Aeneas stayed behind to explore and plot out the walls of his city, a bit over-enthusiastic if you ask me, he sent 100 men carrying gifts and olive branches in wool, seen as peace offerings related to Athene, by the way, not just like random fake marshmallows or something, to present themselves to the Latins and gently let them know that they'd be staying and taking over from now on, if they didn't mind. Of course, no one could miss 100 huge blokes in funny clothes tramping through the forest, so when a messenger told King Latinus what all the commotion was about, he let them in right away. Bit too easy, this, isn't it? Latinus's palace was also a sacred place, as it doubled up as a temple and a senate house. Convenient. Statues of their ancestors were carved out, not at all unlike the Forum of Augustus, hint hint, with images of Italus, Father Sabinus, Saturn, and Janus, of course. Friendly reminder that Augustus closed the gates of Janus for the first time in, like, forever in Rome, which was a huge deal, and meant there was peace in the empire and he was amazing, etc, etc, you know, you get the gist. There were lots of weapons and chariots thrown about too, you know, for good measure. As the Trojans were gawping around, Latinus spoke first. "So then, you're the Trojans. What exactly can we do for you?"
"King!"
Ilioneus, the apparently best spoken of the lot, bowed very low.
"As you are descended from Saturn, our leader Aeneas is descended from Jupiter, so we're basically family. We've been trying to get here for months, because we're wandering around and we were hoping we could have a bit of your land. We're going to be very famous, you see. And you will be too, if you want in. Look, we brought you a sacred cup from Aeneas's dead father in exchange, and some shiny things from Priam, our dead king. He had his head chopped off, you know, though maybe don't, you know, think of that when you wear this headdress. And we brought his lovely clothes too. Not a bad deal, eh?"
Latinus didn't look at them for a while. Though the last relics from a lost city were pretty impressive, it all came together that fate was now in motion. This Aeneas must be the stranger his daughter was to marry. Marvellous. Simply marvellous. He accepted the gifts and grinned. "You can have anything you like, Trojans. Only, I would like to meet your leader myself. Can't imagine he's the shy type. Tell him to pop over, especially as I've had it from the fates that he's to marry my daughter. I'd like to get a good look at my new son-in-law." And he sent them back with 300 horses all decked out in purple and gold. Good thing, you know, they're staying put, isn't it? I mean, can you imagine if they tried to get 300 horses on the boats? It'd just sink, wouldn't they? It's not really very sensible, is it? Anyway, and a special chariot with a pair of horses just for Aeneas that apparently Circe had bred herself. How lovely. But this is going all far too smoothly, isn't it? Not to worry. Here she comes, enter Juno, who was just passing by from Argos and so enraged when she saw Aeneas looking vaguely happy for once that she stopped right in her tracks and made skid marks in the clouds. "Why won't he just bloody die already? His city is defeated. He won't be defeated with it. His city burns. He won't burn with it. The contrary little bastard. What must they think of me? I have literally enlisted sea and sky to kill this man, and he just will not do as he is told. Wife and sister of Jupiter, thwarted by one insignificant little mortal. Rumour will love that one. Get yourself together, Juno. Remember who you are. I cannot use my powers, I cannot appeal to others, but I can certainly move hell. If fate says Aeneas gets his happy ever after, fine. But it doesn't say when, or how, or that it should be easy. I hope Lavinia enjoys her marriage to the second Paris, enjoys the second Troy. The shedding of blood and a few innocent lives will make a secure dowry, I think. Turning around, Juno made her way to the dark cave of the Furies, where Electo lived. She was loathed by her whole family, even her father Pluto, though she had so many ghoulish, crawling faces and was so covered in snakes, who can blame them? Can't imagine she is much of a laugh at family parties, can you? Electo, I have a game for you, Juno smirked, holding her tunic above her ankles so the poison of the gorgons that surrounded Electo didn't dirty the hem. Do not let Aeneas' offer of marriage with the Latins win them over so easily. I need you to uphold my honour. My reputation is at stake here. Do whatever you like to cause trouble. Turn brothers against each other. Raise whole houses of families to the ground. Bring desire of war and rage to the Latins and the Trojans alike. You go by thousands of names and have thousands of ways to cause pain. Go and put them to good use. As cheerfully as a creature of eternal night and despair could muster, Electo went straight to the chamber of Queen Amata in Latium. Amata already had her resting bitch face on and was internally seething that her lush choice for her daughter had quickly been overruled by some random stranger. So this wasn't helped when Electo plucked one of the stakes from her head and chucked it at Amata's heart. It buried itself there immediately, stirring up a frenzy that would destroy the whole palace. Though Amata did not notice, of course. Nor did she notice the great gold necklace, shaped like a serpent, that coiled around her neck, nor the golden ribbon that tangled itself in her hair. You can't seriously be considering handing over our daughter to some stranger, can you, Latinus? Amata was gentle at first, as the poison oozed through her veins, not yet entirely consuming her. Have we learned nothing from those stories of Troy about that Trojan Paris, wasn't it? They have a thing for carrying off other men's women. We promised Turnus. Aren't all people not directly our subjects strangers? Turnus's family is from Mycenae. Technically, that makes him a stranger. Isn't that enough? Latinus ignored her, of course, so Amata's only option was to be entirely possessed by the venom that had soaked through her skin, and she raged through the city like a spinning top. She imitated a Bacchic ritual in the forest, tried to hand over her virginal daughter to the god in an insane attempt to delay the marriage. I recall this involved giving Dionysus some of Lavinia's hair, grown just for him. Charming. Rumour had a field day, and probably bored with their humdrum everyday lives, all the other mothers of Latium joined Amata, singing and screaming and dancing around in animal skins. Amata even sang a wedding hymn for Lavinia and Turnus, whilst brandishing a torch. No regard for health and safety here. And encouraged all the other women to literally let their hair down and initiate themselves into the secret Bacchic rites. Like the ancient version of Nit and Natter, I guess. Pleased with her work so far, Electo then fluttered over to Turnus, who lived in Ardea, founded by Danae. He was fast asleep, so for a bit more excitement, Electo took on the guise of Calibbe, the ancient priestess of Juno, and crept over to the side of Turnus's bed.
I expected more from you, Turnus. Juno has commanded me to get you to get a move on. Are you really going to step aside and let some foreign men take your queen? Your right for the kingdom? Get up! Fight for what is rightly yours. The gods demand it.
Turnus snorted as he rolled over in bed. Don't be stupid. There's nothing to worry about. You're just some old woman with too much time. Go and bother someone else. Juno won't abandon me so entirely. And besides, I want to sleep. War doesn't concern old women. Unsurprisingly, this response was so obnoxious and rude that Alecto exploded with rage and revealed her true form in all its hideous size. Not an overreaction, in my opinion. The sight of this, of her head as Hydra's, her eyes like fire, made Turner shiver with fear. Shiver? I mean, come on, I think he'd be a bit more than shivering, wouldn't he? And she flung him back on the mattress when he tried to, presumably, apologise. Too old, am I? Too frail for battle, am I? I carry war and destruction in my bare hands. This'll teach you to be so impudent. She tossed a flaming torch at his chest, which rooted itself there firmly, burning against his heart. Turnus broke out in a sweat and leapt out of bed, scrambling for his weapons. His lust for battle almost made him sack his whole palace looking for them. He really should just, you know, remember to keep these things in a safe place. He must have made quite a mess. I imagine they were probably under his bed the whole time, you know, teenage boys. Anyway, that aside, the piece was destroyed and Turnus raged like when a firewood crackles against a bronze pot on the fire and the water seethes and froths and pours over, the steam hissing and spitting in all directions. Turnus, young and handsome and impassioned, called the Latins to war, and they were, for some reason, only too quick to agree. Dusting off her palms, Alecto then made her way to Iulus. As I mentioned before, he's grown up very quickly since book 4, and he's got a bit of an attitude on him, so, you know, let's say he's about 13, maybe. Iulus, more than anything else, loved hunting, which gave Alecto the perfect opportunity to inspire a little madness in his hounds. There was a beautiful stag, a deer, that was adored by the whole city of Latium. It had lost its mother when it was young, and it had been raised by hand by Sylvia, the daughter of a herdsman of Latium. The stag was soon tame and followed her and her family around like a puppy, really. It let her wash it in the stream, drape garlands about its antlers, and it probably, you know, even ate scraps from the table. And it was this stag, of course, that Alecto steered Iulus towards and made sure Iulus's arrow would strike right in the stomach. The stag, bleeding and whining profusely, made its way home and died in the arms and tears of Sylvia herself. Alecto made sure then to summon the men from all around, made sure Tyrus, the herdsman, gathered his troops with anything they could find to make a weapon out of. This was the final straw. For the cherry on top, Alecto flew to the top of the farm roof and called the signal to war through a loud horn, which apparently had the voice of Tartarus. I'm not sure what that is, but I can't imagine it's very pleasant. Rivers and trees for miles around shuddered at the sound of it, apparently. The Trojans, naturally, rallied to help Ascanius, who was probably mortified that his game had gone so wrong, and was sure to be grounded for eternity if he ever had a home to be grounded in. The villagers had forgotten they were up against men who had spent 10 years defending Troy. The first to fall was Almo, the eldest son of Tyrus, the herdsman, who was really not doing well from all of this, was he? And then it was pure, unyielding carnage. One man, Glycus, who was just and rich, stepped between the men to try and make the peace. He was killed immediately. Thoroughly pleased with herself and feeling quite smug, Alecto swaggered back to Juno. Ta-da! Your wish is my command, my lady. I can do more, though, if you'd like. I can send rumour to nearby cities, entice them to war, bring them in from all sides, start a second That's enough. The blood and death here will make a suitable marriage hymn for Aeneas and Lavinia, I'm sure. You can go now. Jupiter won't want you wandering about. He says you hurt his eyes. And you smell. I'll take it from here. most put out, Alecto stormed off back to her home in the deepest, darkest cave, surrounded by a fearsome forest and terrible lashings of the sea. Somehow, I don't know how, but go with it, guys. Gods of the underworld usually linger here. There's a rather ugly whirlpool, and Alecto chose to sulk here, lightening the world with her absence. Pfft, bit harsh, that, isn't it? Gosh. Juno then turned to add the finishing touches to her game of murder and destruction. The Latins, carrying the bodies of their dead and encouraged by Turnus, now rush to the palace of Latinus to implore him to rid their kingdom of the Trojans. Amalda and her Bacchic following joined them, and this immense crowd of bloodied men and animal skin clad women was pounding against the palace. But the citadel of Latinus remained unmoved, like a rock in the ocean that is smacked by howling waves again and again. But there is no resisting the wrath of Juno. Latinus called out to the gods, his words falling on deaf ears.
I'm just doing as fate decreed. Why must it be so hard? This sacrilege, Latins. Turnus, you have brought death and suffering upon us. It is too late. You started this. You can end it.
And then he shut himself up in his palace and said no more, and I really can't say that I blame him. In Latium, there was a tradition, as there was in Rome, regarding the gates of Janus. When the gates are closed, all men are at peace. You'll recall that it's Augustus who claimed to be the only one to ever close these. I mentioned this earlier on, but you've really got to get this into your heads, guys. And he was the one who said he'd only ever done it in the whole history of Rome. Please remember this. Very important propaganda. But when the gates are open, they are a symbol of the Latins, and later the Romans, of being at war. Latinus could not bear to open the gates. He could not bear to declare war, but Juno had no problem with coming down and opening them for him. All had been at peace in that area of the world until that very moment. Not that anyone really seemed to mind very much. Apparently, all the men were quite excited for a bit of death and bludgeoning. Now, raise your hand if you've read the Iliad. Please remember that I can't see you, so it's a bit redundant, but raise them anyway. If you have, you'll recall the catalogue of ships. If you haven't, basically, there's this bit where Homer obviously wanted to fill some time. He probably wanted an extra drink. And he spends almost a whole chapter listing off all the men fighting in the Trojan War and where they came from, and frankly, it is terribly dull. Well, this is Virgil's version, and it's absolutely no better, so I'll give you the abridged version. Are you all ready to take notes? Yeah? Cool. First, we've got Mezentius, a cruel man, and his son Lausus. They'll be important. Then, there's Aventinus, a son of Hercules, one of the ones he probably didn't kill, I guess, dressed up in his dad's old lion skin. Lovely. Then we have the twins, Catillus and Coras, and then Caecilius, believed to be the son of Vulcan, whose men were a little odd and they wore strange caps and carried slingshots. Virgil also mentions acorns, and I'm sure they're not gnomes, but that is all I'm seeing right now. You have Messapus, a son of Neptune, Clausus, one of the Sabines, who would go on to be the ancestor of the Claudii, one of the ancient patrician families of Rome, by the way. Helysus, a good mate of Agamemnon, joined in just for the hell of it. And then Ibalus, son of a nymph, who led an army that apparently carried boomerangs, oak helmets, and half-moon shields. Quite inventive, this bit. We've got Ufens, a priest called Umbro, though should priests be fighting, really? Viribus, sent by his mother, which I really doubt, as no mother really wants to send her son to war unless she hates him, which, of course, is highly possible in this world. He was the son of Hippolytus, by the way, who I think was brought back from the dead by Asclepius, but that is really like a whole other story that we don't need to go into right now. And we can't forget at this point to mention how splendid Turnus looked in his triple-plumed helmet, flushed with youth and rage. He had all the common men of Latium around him. And saving the best till last, we have Camilla, the Volscian warrior princess. She was basically the best one there, and let's not deny it. She was one of the fastest runners in the world. So quick that she could basically have skimmed across the ocean. Wherever she went, men and mothers came to stare at her, the enviable picture of agility, sexiness, and model daughter-in-law all in one. Long story short, she's a badass person to have on your side. And I'm going to leave you on that cliffhanger until book 8.